Okay, the first speaker of today's afternoon will be Lucio Meyer. He's from the ETH in Zurich, and he will be talking about the direct collapse model for giant plant formation.
Thanks a lot for the introduction. So my task today will be to give an overview of the competing giant planet formation model, which is based on gravitational instability in gaseous protoplanetary disks. I will start with giving a general description of the conditions for gravitational instability to produce fragments on the scale of giant planets. And I will then spend some time talking about what is becoming now the hottest topic in the context of disk instability, which is the fragmentation of the outer disk at radii larger than 50 AU, which, as you can imagine, is very relevant to the discoveries from direct imaging. And then I will try to describe you how we are starting to be able to make some predictions about the properties of the protoplanets that are formed by disk instability. So I will talk about the issue of the initial mass versus the final mass, and also other properties like the angular momentum of the structures that are formed by disk instability. And if I will have some time, then in the very end, I will discuss briefly results of various people that have shown that you can actually possibly form a core of solids and then enrich the envelope with IZ material, even in clumps formed by disk instability. So, of course, you know, we have to start from the general conditions for disk instability. As you know, the idea, it goes back to many, many years ago, is that if you have a massive disk which is sufficiently massive to become self-gravitating, it may actually become violently gravitationally unstable and fragment into giant planet size clumps of gas. Now, the two conditions that have been investigated by a number of authors, some of them are listed here, but there's many more in the literature out there, for fragmentation of disks, in the case of an isolated disk without accretion, and you will see in the second part of my talk that the new development in the area here is introducing the effect of accretion in the picture. If you don't include accretion, then the two conditions for fragmentation are, first, that your 2RQ parameter has to be lower than 1.5, 1.4, somewhere in the disk. The 2RQ, of course, depends on the angular frequency, on the sound speed, so that the temperature in the disk, and the surface density, that's the gravity, essentially, of your disk. And the second condition is that where Q goes below 1.5, you also need to have cooling time, which is comparable or shorter than the orbital time. Why is that? Because essentially, in disk instability, what happens is that you form strong spiral arms, and the spiral arms develop shocks. And as you can see from this paper by Piger et al., if I look at the heating in the disk, the heating is really localized along the spiral arms, so it's really localized along the density peaks, exactly in the places where you would eventually be able to fragment. So this is the what people describe as self-regulation, so the fact that as the density increases, also the temperature increases within the spiral shocks, and eventually you could reach a tumory stable case with larger than 1.5, in which case the instability will saturate, and you will not go anywhere, you will not fragment. But if your cooling time is short, shorter than the time it takes to eat up the disk significantly, which is of order the orbital time, then you may end up with fragmentation. So these are the two conditions. And if you take typical disk parameters for the early phase of the disk, when the disk may be so massive, you expect to have Q less than 1.5 only in the outer part of the disk, say a radius larger than 5-10 AU. And in this region, you expect temperatures of this range. Now, if these two conditions are met and you are able to fragment, then that's the kind of picture that you would get, where you have clumps forming along the spiral arms. These clumps can become gravitationally bound, as has been shown by several people. And this process, once it takes place, it can be very fast because it's related, again, to the orbital time scale. And the orbital time scale is of order a few tens of years in these disks. So if it happens, it happens extremely fast. Now, the sensitivity to the cooling time is quite evident here. These are some older simulations that I ran a few years ago, where essentially I was varying the cooling time. The cooling time was a fixed fraction of the orbital time at the location, the reference location in the disk. And you can see that if I have a cooling time that is slightly shorter than the orbital time, I produce several clamps. As I raise the cooling time to slightly longer than the orbital time, I produce only one clamp. If I raise this even more to about two orbital times, I would produce no clamps at all. So the cooling time condition is extremely important, and the disk is the outcome is extremely sensitive to variations of factors of two in the cooling time. Now, if you are satisfying these two conditions and you produce the fragments, then already several years ago, there were some attempts to look at what happens several orbital times afterwards, after you form them. So initially, you have this phase in which you have several clamps, in this case, about seven clamps forming on a scale of about one to a few Jupiter masses. The clamps typically merge because the spiral arms are not circular, of course. They are eccentric. And so they bring the trajectories of the clamps often to intersect. And then you end up, after several tens of orbital times, with a more stable configuration in which you are left typically with only a few clamps on moderately eccentric orbits around 0.1 to 0.3. And this is one of the longest calculations that we published a few years ago in the PP5 chapter led by Dick Durison. We took it to about 150 orbital times. And at that point, we had two clamps surviving with a mass between 1.5 and 4 Jupiter masses. And the third one was actually tidally sheared as it moved closer to the inner region of the disk, closer to the star. These older simulations were extremely simplified in the way we treated the thermodynamics of the disk. So they were simply either assuming a fixed cooling time, or they were moving from different equation of states, from, say, isothermal to adiabatic, as the density was increasing. Then in the more recent years, several groups, as I'll show you in the next slide, have started to play with radiative transfer, so to really look into the actual cooling properties of the disk self-consistently. Now, before I go to that, just a very quick digression on whether we understand the numerics in the problem. There's been a lot of work in this as well. And the main issue that has been discussed by several papers in the last 10 years is whether you have to worry about artificial effects in the codes that may lead to fragmentation when this should not happen. So this has been quite settled by now. With the codes that we have now, we can say that with sufficiently high resolution, and this is a criterion that has been shown by Nelson, for example. If you have an SPH simulation, you want to have a larger, more than six smoothing volumes. The smoothing volume is the resolution length of your simulation. Or if you have a grid simulation, more than eight cells per tumory mass, to resolve correctly fragmentation. If you have less than these requirements, you may actually produce artificial fragments. So nowadays, simulations obey this criteria. A few years ago, not all of them were obeying that, so it was an issue. And I'm just showing you now the level of excellent agreement that we now have between different codes. When you have conditions set up to give you fragmentation, the convergence is quite striking. Here you see one of the simulations with our SPH code, gasoline, with moderate to higher resolution, and the same with flash, the adaptive mesh refinement code originally developed to study supernova explosions. And you see, which is impossible essentially, looking at density map to say which is which. And I want also to draw your attention to the fact that as you increase the resolution, this is the density scale, as you increase the resolution, the clamps that are forming here get denser at the same level, roughly, both in flash and in the SPH. So when we know that we should have physical fragmentation, and the codes have, are obeying these resolution requirements, we do get extremely good convergence between grid and SPH, which is extremely good because you want to be able to study the problem with as many techniques as possible, to not be bound to a specific assumption in your numerical model. Now, in the last few years, again, people have started to look into implementing radiative transfer in the simulations. And so the question then is, when you do that, do you actually get the short cooling times that you need to fragment? And the answer is, it depends on where you are in the disk. If you are in the inner disk, it may be a problem because the midplane of the disk at, say, 5 AU is optically thick if you have a 0.1 solar masses disk. If you are in the outer part of the disk, then it may be no problem, as I will show you in the next slides. So for the inner disk, and the inner disk I define this region here, there is at the moment still disagreement between different groups. Here I'm showing you some work that we published a few years ago, where we did look at the effect of changing various parameters in the way we were implementing our radiative transfer module, which was essentially fluximeter diffusion. But the key thing in this kind of game is to decide how to leak radiation from the edge of the disk. So once you have done your diffusion, then the photons come to the surface, then you have to decide how efficiently to radiate away your energy. And again, you know, it's a cooling time criterion. And as you see here, this RS parameter is the ratio between the emitting surface area and the geometric surface area of the disk. And as I vary this from 1.5 to, say, where is it here? 1.5 to 1.2, I can go from fragmentation to no fragmentation because I'm moving my cooling time from slightly shorter to slightly longer than the orbital time. The other thing that was realized is that because the midplane is optically thick, you cannot cool it fast enough and get the photons to the surface fast enough for fragmentation to happen. You need to have some other mechanism, a non-radiative mechanism that can redistribute it as fast as you need it. And so some people, our group and also Alan Boss's group, found that at least in some of the simulations, there are convective-like motions that happen in the midplane of the disk, which seem to redistribute the thermal energy on the right cooling, on the right time scale. But this is still debated. There's no consensus on this. Now, the other thing which we found, and I'm going to say something more about this in the next slide, is the sensitivity to the molecular weight mu that we were using in the simulations. So you see here, if I compare, for example, this run here with this under run here, they have the same efficiency of radiation at the surface, but one has a solar molecular weight, the other one has a molecular weight higher than solar, and the one that has higher molecular weight fragments, while this does not. Why is this happening? And what is that we have to think about for this molecular weight? Why we look at this? But before I go to that, I'm showing you some recent work by Alan Boss with fluximeter diffusion, where he also still sees clumps forming in his disk. Now, the molecular weight. So remember what I told you before, that disk instability is a competition between eating through the spiral shock, which tend to stabilize the disk against fragmentation, and the cooling of the gas, the radiative cooling of the gas. Now, you can, of course, bring the disk towards fragmentation, changing the cooling of the gas, but you can also do it by changing the heating. So the compression of heating in the spiral shocks depends on a number of factors, including your molecular weight. So if you reduce the PDV work in the spiral arms, you reduce the compression of heating, you make effectively it's like making the cooling time a bit shorter, okay? But just changing the heating rather than the cooling. Now, how this could happen in a real disk? Well, we in a paper of a few years ago, we developed a model in which we showed that there is an interesting connection between development of spiral arms and the molecular weight. So Rice et al. And others have shown that when you have developed spiral structure in a disk, if you have solids in the disk, for example, 50 centimeters particles here, they tend to migrate towards the pressure maxima, which are located along the spiral arms. So essentially what you have is an increase of the solid to gas ratio in the spiral arms. But in the spiral arms, the spiral shocks bring the temperature to more than 200K typically. So you could vaporize a lot of grains. And if you do some calculation, you see that the vaporization of ice grain can actually drive an increase of the molecular weight. If you couple that with the fact that you enhance your solid to gas ratio in the spiral arms by the migration towards the pressure maxima, you can show that you can get easily from a solar molecular weight to a molecular weight as high as 2.85 in the spiral arms. So this is a possible interesting effect that may actually help the disk to fragment by reducing heating, and also has the interesting consequence that high metallicity in this scenario would favor fragmentation, which would be quite consistent with what we see in the frequency of giant planets as a function of metallicity. Now, as I said, the fragmentation of the inner disk is still debated. Other groups, like the groups of Dick Durison and Aaron Bolli, do not find fragmentation within 30 AU. This is an example of a simulation by Aaron Bolli where he has very strong spiral arms, but self-regulation wins, and you don't produce fragments. However, even in their group, there are some cases in which they do see fragmentation in the inner disk, but they need to play with parameters in a very extreme way. For example, reducing the opacity by orders of magnitude. This is sort of an experiment. It doesn't have to be realistic, just to show that you have to go to very low opacity, because they don't have this convective cooling. They don't see convective cooling, so they really rely on the cooling of the gas itself, on the relative cooling. And so only with extremely low opacity, 10 to the minus 4, the solar value, they can get fragmentation. They speculate that this may happen if you have very rapid dust settling, which essentially reduces the opacity in the disk where you need it. Now let's go to the most interesting area, which has been growing a lot in the last few years, so the fragmentation of large radii. Of course, a large radii, more than 50 U, you are in a much easier environment for disk instability because the gas is much lower density, so the typical optical depth is lower than 1, and so you expect the cooling time to be shorter than the orbital time. So you expect to be in the right conditions. Of course, you know, this is a good case to explain the imaged planets at very large distances. But as Alan has pointed out a few years ago, it's true that you reduce the cooling time, but now you have to cope with the fact that you have lower surface density. So would you be able to still get the other condition, Q less than 1.4? Because you need to have both conditions. And Alan, in some earlier experiments, showed that it was actually hard to have it, and he was not finding fragmentation at a radius of order 40 or 50 AU. But now we have the new ingredient, which came into the game in the last couple of years, and that's the fact that you should not keep thinking of the disk as an isolated entity. We are considering these that are massive. This is the early stage of the protoplanetary disk, when, very likely, it is still embedded in the molecular envelope and is still accreting mass. So Aaron Bolli wrote this very nice paper last year in which he showed that envelope accretion can actually drive the disk towards fragmentation very easily. If you write down the Q parameter, its variation is essentially given by the variation of these three terms. So you can change the cooling time, you can change also the surface density. In a disk which is isolated, the maximum redistribution of surface density due to this gravitational instability itself is given by this expression here, where alpha is 0.06, as was shown by Lodato and Rice. Alpha 0.06 is the maximum alpha effective viscosity that you can have and still avoid fragmentation. So let's take it as the maximum viscosity that you can have in a stable gravitationally active disk. Now, if you have an envelope accretion rate which is occurring roughly at this value of Cs cubed divided by G, is the classic, you know, Lee-Enshu envelope accretion, and you divide this by this, you find immediately that if you have alpha 0.06, this term, the envelope accretion rate, for typical properties of class 0 to class 1 disks, is much higher than the internal distribution of surface density. What does this mean? It means that the surface density will pile up due to the accretion from the envelope, and the redistribution in the disk will not be fast enough to remove this pileup of surface density. You will have an increase of surface density in the region just at the boundary with the envelope. And so that's what Aaron showed, that if he has accretion, he can easily bring the disk towards fragmentation, even in the very outer lower density part of the disk, at a radii of 100 or 150 AU. Now, we looked into that more recently in a real protostellar collapse calculation with my student Tristan Ayfield, and we actually zoom in a molecular core collapse simulation to follow with very high resolution the first clump, the first core, sorry, that collapses and forms a disk. And here is what you find. You find fragmentation very rapidly. We were using a very simplified equation of state, and the disk that fragments in this condition is nearly adiabatic, so it's not cooling. But it fragments because the accretion rate is extremely high, 5 times 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year, much higher than any rate at which you can redistribute the mass within the disk by gravitational instability. So we confirm the results of Aaron Bolli with a realistic protostellar collapse simulation. And the clumps that we form are on the IMAS scale. They are around 5 and 7 Jupiter masses. In passing, I just want to note that we also looked at what happens if you have two cores collapsing nearby rather than just one. If you have a binary system Like in this case, you have a second core forming along a filament. Now what happens is you have two protoplanetary disks that are assembling from the gaseous filaments. And it's interesting that if you start with the same conditions, but you just have a binary now, the evolution of the disk is different. So in the isolated case, I just showed you fragmentation. In this case, in which you have a binary, you don't actually have fragmentation. And the reason why you don't is because in the binary case, you don't build the outer part of the disk, because your angular momentum goes into the binary rather than going into the outer part of the disk. And so your Toomey parameter ramps up with time in the outer part of the disk where you would be able to fragment. You never get very low Toomey Q, and you're not able to fragment. So the prediction here would be the binaries inhibit fragmentation. The initial masses of the planets formed by disk instability, if you look at what people have found in literature, I think more or less we can say that the typical masses at formation is around 1 to 6 Jupiter masses. These are old simulations of mine with very simplified thermodynamics. These are newer ones with radiative transfer, with fluximity diffusion. And this is the mass function that I get by stacking many simulations together. And again, it peaks close to 2 Jupiter masses in this case. Now, these are newer calculations of the extended disks that were published this month on Icarus. This is the disk with a size of about 400 AU. And you have fragmentation radii between 50 and 100 AU, and you form three clumps of a mass comprised between 1.5, if I remember correctly, and 2 Jupiter masses at the beginning of the simulation. And the disk is accreting at the fairly high accretion rates. And so we use the simulation to investigate why the masses are what they are. Okay, so we want to provide a description, a physical understanding of the initial masses of the clumps, because that's an important question. What are the initial masses and why? And so what we did is, first guess you can do is, do they correspond somehow to the Toomey mass? The Toomey mass is the mass within a volume with a size of the Toomey wavelength. The Toomey wavelength is the most unstable wavelength in your system, which is given by this expression here. So it's a natural scale, right? Now, the Toomey wavelength at the location of fragmentation for this clump, for example, is of order 40 AU. But with SPH, we can track the particles that end up in the, in the clump and see where they were distributed initially. And the scale of the initial distribution of particles that produce the clump is actually a factor of 2.3 less than the scale given by the Toomey wavelength. So in other words, the fragmentation scale is smaller than the one that you get from the Toomey wavelength. This is not surprising because remember that the Toomey wavelength is a concept of linear stability analysis, whereas the fragmentation occurs in the spiral arm when you're already away from the linear regime. So in this paper by Bori et al., we actually looked at a model that considered the properties of the spiral arm and looks at the self-gravity within the spiral arm, and we're able to predict the modified Toomey mass, which essentially can be expressed like here, using the axisymmetric disk properties with a correction, this FG parameter, which is about 2.5, and gives you a lower mass compared to the Toomey mass. And here, we looked at the clumps in the simulation, the three crosses, and how they fit models, analytic models based on this mass, and you can actually compare the crosses with these two are 2D models, essentially, slightly different in the parameters. And you can see that they are fairly in agreement within a factor of 2 or 3 with the simulations. And the point is, the typical mass that you expect is around 1 Jupiter mass, okay? If you had used the Toomey mass, you would get something much bigger, of order 8 to 10 Jupiter mass. But this is wrong because it's linear, whereas here we are not linear anymore. So this is important. The initial masses are understood well in terms of this modified Toomey wavelength, and they are of order of Jupiter mass. We started looking at the properties of the clumps that you form, and already a few years ago, we made the point that these are rotating, rapidly rotating structures. When we look at the latest simulations of outer disk fragmentation, we do see interesting phenomena. Not only they are rotating clumps, you have face-on views and edge-on views of 2 of the clumps, but some of them undergo processes that are typical in protostars. For example, this clump becomes bar unstable here is that you can see the prolateness in the edge-on view, typical of a bar and stable structure. And here you see the bar from the top end. We stopped the simulation shortly after the bar instability because we ran out of computing time. And then you have to speculate what will happen next. Would the clam redistribute its mass and angular momentum due to the bar instability? Maybe yes. You can use an analytical model even to calculate the centrifugal radius of the clams, and it's also found to be quite in agreement with simulations. The point I want to make here is the centrifugal radius is a fewer U of order the clam size that we have in the simulations, which means rotation is important. It's extremely important. So now, these are the initial properties, but what are the final properties? Because we want to know them in order to draw some correspondence with real giant planets. This, of course, is a very difficult question because you will need a simulation that runs much longer than we can afford now. We typically spend months to evolve just 10 or 20 orbits when we have radiative transfer and all the physics in. But this is only a small fraction of the evolutionary time of these clamps. So what you can do is you can build models, analytical models, that extrapolate from the simulations. That's what Aaron did in a recent paper, where essentially he fit the final states of the clamps with polytropes and then evolved further in time using essentially a stellar collapse model, a quasi-static collapse model. And he found these interesting upper limits on the final mass of the clamps, where the final mass is assumed to be the mass that the clamps reach at the stage at which the density and the temperature become high enough for H2 dissociation to happen in the clamp and drive the formation of a second core, like in a star. You can imagine at that stage, the clamp decouples strongly from the surrounding flow. So that's a possible working definition of a final mass. And you can see that the final mass, depending on the initial mass, can be, if you have a small planet, one or two Jupiter masses, it can be 10 times higher if you have a large planet because it contracts much faster, reaches much faster the H2 dissociation regime. It is actually very close to the initial mass. The point here is the final mass is as large as 10, 15 Jupiter masses, but it's not much more than that. So it's still in the regime of super Jupiters. We are starting to look into this directly with the simulations now, but again, this is very daunting, and I can show you these new results of where we reached 3 Jupiter radii in resolution in one particular clamp, and you can start to see that we begin to see this decoupling between a core and an envelope. We are not yet at the temperature of dissociation. We are still at 1,000 Kelvin, so we need to go to even higher density and temperature to see the formation of the second core. But clearly, there is a dense core and a very large diffuse envelope, and the diffuse envelope is actually what takes most of the angular momentum, is this sort of circumplanetary disk, whereas the core is this very dense central clamp here. Now, Stamatellos have looked at the same, including dissociation, for very large clamps, where the contraction is so fast that it can follow them for a higher fraction of their dynamical time. And they do find that when H2 dissociation occurs, you have the plateau that you see also in protostars, so your temperature starts to grow very little with density, and you have a dynamical collapse. So it's sort of similar to what you expect for protostars. So the final mass will be actually determined by a lot of parameters that we haven't looked into yet, the thermodynamics, the gap opening, or gap starvation mass, and Crater et al. Have a nice paper out where they show that the gap starvation mass depends a lot on this viscosity. As Jack has discussed for core accretion, even here, this viscosity is crucial. If you have a low viscosity disk, you may have 8 Jupiter masses. If you have a high viscosity disk, this may be much bigger than that. Simulation, like the one that I just showed you in the movie, tell you that there is a variety of outcomes. 3 clamps, one of them merges with another one, with the red one, it becomes huge. It's clearly not a giant planet, more a brown dwarf. The other one, this blue one, instead stays always close to a Jupiter mass, migrates inward, and actually gets tidally destroyed because we lack the resolution in the inner region of the disk, but we probably survive at this level of mass for a long time. And that just to conclude, recently, Ravid Ellet and others have started to look at the possibility of accreting solids and forming a core and enriching the envelope in a clamp form by disk instability. It is a relevant question because if it doesn't happen, it could be a way to distinguish between core accretion and disk instability. But if it happens, then it's more complicated because even this would not be able to give you a difference between the two models. And the bottom line is that Ravid finds that you can enrich these clamps from one to even 100 Earth masses, depending on the mass of the planets. The planets that are more enriched are the ones that contract on a longer time scale. So the smaller ones have more time to accumulate solids before the temperature becomes high enough to vaporize the grains. And these are also the ones that can produce a core due to the sedimentation of the grains. So the prediction is that Jupiter, in principle, could have formed even in GI, by GIs, and have accumulate the right amount of solids in the core and in the envelope. And we got to the same conclusions with Willy Benz and his group in Bern. We did similar calculations where we also find enrichment in two of the clamps from my simulations to the level of up to a few Earth masses in a very diffuse clamp and less in a hotter, denser clamp. So this is another area which needs to be investigated further. If you leave, if a clamp gets destroyed at the center, it leaves a core, you may actually have a way to deliver a core to the center of the disk. This is a fairly crazy idea, but I think it's interesting. You may have a way to incubate the clamp, the core in the clamp, and then leave it once the clamp gets destroyed in the region of the disk by tides. So here is a conclusion slide. I think the main point is now we have a good understanding of the initial mass of the planets forming disk instability, which we didn't have before. It's of order of Jupiter mass. The outer disk is very likely is in the conditions of fragmentation most of the times because of the envelope accretion. So the envelope accretion is the critical parameter that gives you fragmentation. And you can probably form a solid core and enrich your envelope even in clamps by disk instability, which makes it very difficult to use the amount of solid as a way to distinguish planets formed by this or the core accretion mechanism. And I will stop here.
Thank you very much. So questions to this obviously wide topic.
You put up an equation showing the gap opening mass from the paper that Andrew and I wrote with Caitlin Kratter, and that was really actually very misleading because in that, to get that 8 Jupiter masses, we needed to say, and this was based on scaling to the models that Jack Lissauer showed earlier, that the viscosity was 10 to the minus 4, and it's really difficult to believe that that's the case in a disk that was just unstable. And it's actually, you know, a more general, it's a big problem that if the disk is accreting continuously after the planets have formed, you just can't get that material to go from outside the planets onto the star without a lot of it ending up on the star. So you're just much more likely to end up with a brown dwarf. So you really need to see a lot of brown dwarfs here to make this work.
You have probably seen this recent paper by Vorobyev and Basel where they clearly show that you could have different phases of fragmentation, not one episode of fragmentation only. And you may have a situation, very likely, as you say, in which the first episode of fragmentation, where the accretion rate is high, you produce brown dwarfs. But as the accretion rate in this goes down, when you transition from one class 1 to class 2, at the very last phase of accretion, you get Jupiter-sized planets that then don't accrete anymore because the accretion rate goes down. So you could have more than one phase of fragmentation. I think the only way to settle this down is to have protostellar collapse calculations that go far enough in time to show you whether you have these different phases.
That's possible, but those simulations don't actually allow the center of mass to move, and so they can't actually get binaries out of them. So I think that doesn't actually answer the question yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Okay, you have to discuss something.
Lucio, that's an absolutely great talk. Since you explain everything, and there's so much information in your talk that I will concentrate on the 10%. I think I understood a little bit. But I just want to, I have a question and a comment. And let me start with the comment. The comment has to do with the simulations by Stamateros and collaborators. These simulations are pure hydro simulation, right? So these guys need very, very massive disks, which hydro simulations lead to, but we know from observations, Philippe André, Phil Myers, and now Herschel, that these massive disks do not exist. Mm-hmm. And the reason is all these disks are strongly magnetized, and because you accumulate magnetic pressure, you get a Lindenbelt tower, magnetic tower, which prevent fragmentation. So I will be very, very cautious about the number of fragments you get with pure hydro code. That's my comment. And my question is, when you kind of, you put the accretion from the envelope as a shoe-like accretion rate, and if you can go backwards, and there is, and you estimate the diffusion times, I mean the dissipative time scale with an alpha, kind of an alpha parameterization. I guess it's a Sonayev-Shakur-like alpha, so keep going maybe. And one of the points, you kind of mimic your gravitational instability viscosity by an alpha. And I'm a bit surprised because, I mean, by definition, gravitational instability is a global instability, a long wavelength stability, whereas turbulence or dissipation is a local dissipation. So even though I know people like Lin and Pringle have tried to parameterize the gravitational instability as an alpha parameter, as a matter of fact, it doesn't really work. So I would expect the dissipation to be on a dynamical time scale rather than on a viscous time scale.
So this parameterization with alpha actually is not my work, but it has been tested extensively by the group of Ken Rice and Giuseppe Lodato, and actually Phil Armitage is here, so he may comment on that. And it is they have shown that in most cases, for a wide variety of these parameters, they are able to explain the mass transfer rates within the disk with a parameterization using a local alpha. And their point is that when you can actually distinguish between the fragmentation and the stability regime in the disk by saying that you have a maximum stress given by a maximum alpha, which is around 0.06. Of course, as you say, it may be that it works in some situations, in other situations it doesn't work. But even other simulations done in other contexts, for example, in the formation of black hole accretion, circumnuclear disks in the nuclei of galaxies, by Andres Escala and Mark Krumholz, they find that the maximum alpha that you can get if you force this equivalent definition of alpha coming from Shakur and Sonyaev can be a bit larger than that. Can be order 0.3, for example. But again, even if you have 0.3, if you take this accretion rate, you will still have envelope accretion being several times the inward mass transfer rate.
Next.
I agree. Actually, I wanted to put up very quickly, if I can make it. Well, it's taking time. Let me say that I agree completely. The Stamatelos disks are unrealistic. In fact, they shatter on a few dynamical times. And I didn't show them because I didn't want to be bad with them.
Okay, next question.
Hi, Ed Thomas. Wow, so you form these things at HR8799 type distances, and then you migrate them in. Mm-hmm. That's a kick in the pants. I'm just wondering, I mean, so this is, and I'm glad you put the migration in there, because this is one thing I often wonder about with these simulations. Because you do need such massive disks, you expect a large amount of migration after you form these planets. And I'm wondering, maybe I missed it, do you have a way also of making these things at these large radii and then keeping them somewhere around there? Or do they always migrate big distances?
I want to be honest and say that the question is completely open. We don't know the answer yet. As I showed you here, we have a situation where two of the, in this particular simulation, but we could imagine others would give a different result, we have a situation where two of the clamps actually go outward. Well, it's not clear from this plot that these are the two that merge in the end. And this other one goes inward. And they go outward and inward by several tens of a U on a time scale of a few orbital times. It's extremely fast. And it's not the standard migration, but it's something which we have to think about how to describe it, but certainly has to do with the interaction between the self-gravitating spiral waves.
And I guess the disk is still very clunky.
The disk is still redistributing its mass a lot. So the answer to your question is we don't know yet.
So, hey, Lucio. Nice talk. So I think we're sort of in agreement that obviously the main issue is once you form one of these objects in a massive disk, how much does it accrete? And we may disagree on the numbers and viscosities. So the initial fragment mass may be sort of a secondary issue, but it is still an interesting one. And so I agree with your general claim that you could might expect that in reality you get something different from the simple Tumor estimate. But I'm a little surprised of the direction it goes. Because your argument is that because you're collapsing in a dense spiral arm, you get a different result. Yeah. But what we find in the particle simulations is that when you collapse something from a denser medium, you have larger mass and larger length scales, you wind up getting actually bigger fragments. And
yep.
So it's interesting that you get the opposite direction.
Because it's a spiral shock, so you not only have a higher density, but you also have a stronger pressure gradient that develops along the shock. In fact, in the paper with Aaron, we showed that a nice way for the tumory length, here I showed the tumory mass, for the tumory length, you can actually show that the modified tumory length is the standard tumory length divided by the Mach number square of the shock. So in other words, if you have a weak spiral arm, which means you're closer to the linear regime, you recover the tumory length.
Okay, last question while John sets up his talk.
Is there a continuum between your gaseous instability, disk instability with rapid accretion and fragmentation into binarity?
Fragmentation to binarity, you mean in the protostellar core?
In a protostellar core, yeah.
It's a good question. We actually didn't look into that. These particular cases that I showed where we have a binary system forming, the secondary system does not form because of fragmentation in a disk, mm-hmm. but forms because a filament becomes self-gravitating and collapses. So it doesn't form in the same way.
Sheila, is this a little bit more time? Is there another question? Not. Okay, then you just go ahead.